You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
I'm Drew Leiter.
And I'm Cletus Jacobs.
And we're inviting you to join us as we delve into the dawn of the DC. We'll be reviewing new titles such as The Unstoppable Doom Patrol, Shazam, Green Lantern, Titans, Justice Society of America, and more. We'll also be reviewing DC Television's final season of The Flash, Titans, and Doom Patrol. Join us every week on the Earth Station DCU Podcast, part of the ESO Network.
Hey everybody, welcome to this week's episode of Monster Attack, the podcast dedicated to old monster movies. Well, we had originally said last week with the show we did with Clay Sayer that we were going to follow up The Howling with another big werewolf monster movie from the same time period, actually from the same year, American Werewolf in London. Well, technical problems prevailed and we weren't able to do that show this week. So we're going to do that show next week. This week, we're going back to the Halls of Hammer for a classic vampire tale from 1970, Taste the Blood of Dracula. Now, you know, it's a bittersweet type movie, and I'm going to be kind to it because I like the movie a lot. And again, when I first saw it, it was probably around 1971. It was about a year after it was released. It was released officially in the United States in June of 1970. I saw it on a rerun through the theaters about a year later. This time I was in Raleigh, North Carolina. And I saw this at, it wasn't at the Cardinal Theater. That was the big theater that was right down the street from where I was living, a big double theater. You've heard Mark Maddox and I talk about that one when we've talked about Raleigh, North Carolina. But it was one of the theaters downtown. I think it was might have been the State Theater that ended up showing a lot of monster movies. I saw a lot of Godzilla films there, a lot of disaster movies there, and things of that. It's right there in the center of Raleigh. I don't even know if it's there anymore. But we're coming on a time now where Hammer is starting to drop off a little bit. They start getting into a little bit of financial trouble, and the movies, while they're still good, aren't just quite as outstanding as some of the ones that they had done before that. Now, this film, Taste the Blood of Dracula, is the true sequel to Dracula Has Risen from the Grave. And you know, a lot of people didn't realize that this was made as a sequel. The movie starts where the other one left off. So it wasn't until I actually got in the theater and watched the movie that I realized it was a sequel. It was not marketed as one. It was just marketed as a film featuring Count Dracula with Christopher Lee and all of that. And one of the reasons the marketing campaign didn't go as well as it probably should have, or wasn't done as well as Hammer's been known to do it, is because for a while there, Hammer didn't know if Christopher Lee was going to come back and do this or not. And they thought that maybe this is going to be sort of like a Brides of Dracula scenario where they were going to have to get someone else. So they had arranged to get Ralph Bates to play the vampire in the movie that they were going to make. Pretty certain that Lee wasn't going to come back. And then all of a sudden, Lee comes back, but there was another impetus behind that as well, because the distributor said, "Oh no, you're going to get Christopher Lee. He is going to be Dracula, or we're not financing the film." So they were able to put Christopher Lee back in. Now Ralph Bates remains in the film, and he plays what I would say sort of an acolyte for Count Dracula, one of his assistants, one of his evildoers that is a human who assists with the vampire coming back to life, similar to what we saw in Dracula, Prince of Darkness, and also in Dracula Has Risen from the Grave as well. There was always that one person in every Hammer vampire film, with the exception of Horror of Dracula. That one person that on the human side that would be able to watch out for Dracula during the daytime hours and also assist in bringing him back, as we saw in Dracula AD 1972. So Ralph Bates has a fairly important role in this, just not as extensive as originally planned. He was going to play a similar part to what David Peel did in The Brides of Dracula. So again, it's a little beneath where we saw Dracula, Prince of Darkness, and of course, Dracula's Risen from the Grave, which up until this point, a lot of people felt was the best Dracula film they had ever made. I was always of the school of Brides of Dracula, but Dracula Has Risen from the Grave with Veronica Carlson in it, it just really raised it to a big level for my taste as well. So with the exception of Brides of Dracula, out of all the Christopher Lee Dracula films, I felt that Dracula Has Risen from the Grave was the best one that they had done. So this one slips a little beneath it, but it's still a pretty good film. You know, we don't see Terrence Fisher or Freddie Francis involved with this film. The director is Peter Sadsny. He would go on and direct several other Hammer films, Hammer horror films, including Countess Dracula, Hands of the Ripper, Hammer House of Horror, Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson, and one that was not a Hammer production, but Return of the Saint. You might remember when we talked about Ian Ogilvy a few weeks back when Ian was playing the Saint in that reprisal of the classic TV show. So as a director, he's got quite a lot of experience, 65 credits altogether. And I think he does a pretty good job on this. To be a director of a Hammer vampire film, you had a real challenge ahead of you, because with all of the colors and stuff, you know, we always talk about the color palette that Hammer films used. Just brilliant stuff, beautiful stuff. And of course, these were, you know, all period pieces. You needed a darkness. You needed this pall of evil that sort of hung over it. And especially in this one, when we get into the storyline, you'll understand that even more. I do want to say that if you have not seen Taste the Blood of Dracula, and there may be a lot of people that haven't seen it, because a lot of people sort of stopped watching them after Dracula Has Risen from the Grave and didn't really give the 70s Dracula films much of attention. Things were falling off for Hammer. But there were still a couple of good ones out there, as we mentioned with Scars of Dracula, which would come out right after this film. So that, you know, they still had a little life left in them. And I still think that Dracula AD 72 was a lot better than the critics said it was. I think it played pretty well. I just think it was a film that people weren't quite ready for, to see Dracula in a contemporary setting. This one, again, takes place same time as Dracula Has Risen from the Grave, and it opens up with a popular character actor, not only from Hammer films, but British films in general, Roy Kinnear, who plays sort of we assume he's sort of a peddler, some kind of a salesman. He's riding on a carriage with two other people, showing them this snow globe he has for sale. And he's got a suitcase full of all kinds of products. One of the people watching is clearly mentally challenged, a big hulking guy. And the guy with him is like, you better do what the guy wants, because he's reaching out. He wants it. He wants this snow globe. And Roy's character is named Weller, is putting it back into the suitcase and saying, oh, well, no, that's okay. And then the guy ends up getting up off the seat and throttling Weller and throwing him out of the carriage along with his suitcase and his possessions as the carriage goes riding off. So this film starts with a bang. And we're gonna get a little right into this beginning before we tell you about some of the other people you're going to see in this movie. But Roy Kinnear, you might remember, I will always remember him as playing Algernon in the movie Help. You know, he was the assistant to the mad scientist who was always trying to find a way to change the outlet connections because it was the wrong polarity or something or other. Yeah, but Roy just shows up in so many British films. Very, very, very popular character actor, a little bit comedic. And he's a little comedic in this, because, you know, Hammer would throw a little comedy into some of their horror films. And this is about the only comedy you're going to see because it immediately gets dark. And this is why I wanted to get to this early, because you've got these brilliant colors and these great looking sets and locations that they're shooting on. And you don't want that to overcome the feeling of dread and evil that sort of lies over this whole film. Because as Weller is picking himself up, and he's all right, he's just banged up a little bit, but he's not seriously hurt, just probably bruised, picking up his case with his stuff and a bag of his clothes and things like that. All of a sudden, you hear this horrible howling, someone in extreme pain, agonizing pain. And it sounds a little familiar. Now, I remember sitting in the theater thinking, wait a minute. I recognize that. And it's from the tail end of Dracula Has Risen from the Grave. And Weller makes his way around to where the moaning and the horrible screaming is coming from. And we see Dracula with the cross impaling him. Remember, in Dracula Has Risen from the Grave, he fell off the precipice and down where the big cross that had been on the door of his castle was sitting upright in the dirt, positioned just perfectly for him to fall on. And he starts staggering around and screaming while the protagonist of that film, remember that he was agnostic or atheist. I think they called him an agnostic in that, starts praying the prayer as Dracula dies. Now, we don't hear the prayer in the background. So Weller is in a different spot where maybe he can't hear that. But, you've got the wind and you've got the lightning and all that. And you've got Dracula, blood's coming out of his eyes, and you could tell he's in agonizing pain. And then he falls over and starts turning to dust. He says all that's left is his cape and a big locket, a big chain that he used to wear around his neck. And Weller makes his way over there, just absolutely shocked at what's going on. And he picks up this locket. It's covered in blood. And he wipes the blood away a little bit, and he can see the name Dracula. And he goes, this is Dracula's blood. And at that point, he's going to grab that item and probably the cape as well, because he's a huckster. He's a peddler. He's a salesman. And we later find out in the film that he has like a knick-knack shop, right? Antique store type thing, maybe a step down from actual, antiques. But more knickknacks and, you would almost consider it like tourist souvenir type things when we get to see the shop. That will be coming next. So we're going to stop it right there for a minute. And again, last chance, if you've not seen this film, you might want to go see it. Now, you may have to pay to see it. Amazon Prime has a beautiful restored copy of it, but it's going to cost you about $3 to see it. But the film is easy to find. It's on DVD, Blu-ray. It's in a lot of compilations of Hammer films. It's in their Dracula series. So it is not a hard film to find. So you might want to see it before we get into this storyline, because I will spoil everything there is to spoil. I will say that one of the criticisms this film had was that a lot of the critics, and again, you know my opinion about critics back then, talking about monster movies, they just didn't get it. They just said, well, it's the same old Hammer stuff. Well, you remember when I talked about Scars of Dracula, they got the same criticism that this one did as well. Same old Hammer stuff. But that's what we wanted. So folks, if you're a big Hammer fan and you liked the vampire movies that Hammer did, then you're going to like Taste the Blood of Dracula, because it's going to provide you with everything you would expect to see in a traditional Hammer Dracula film. All right, so let's get to our cast here. It's got an outstanding cast of people that you'll recognize mainly from British film and television. And we will kick things off, of course, with our guest. Can you guess who our lead is? It's Christopher Lee, of course. And what can we say about Christopher Lee? Of course, we had seen him in Horror of Dracula, Dracula, Prince of Darkness, Dracula is Risen from the Grave. We would see him again in about three more Dracula films after this one, finishing up with the Satanic Rites of Dracula. During this year, he would also make Scars of Dracula and You remember the Jess Franco film, Count Dracula. So he would appear as Dracula three different times. So I got a feeling that it wasn't so much he didn't want to play Dracula. I have a feeling that some of his concerns about putting on the cape again for Hammer probably involved money. And he does get to speak a little more in this, but he is very imposing in this. And he got some criticism from some of the critics on that. No, he was exactly what we wanted in this. He's a very, very dark, imposing figure. Okay, our next character is Jeffrey Keane, and he plays a man by the name of William Hargood. Now, he is the founder of this club that these three guys have gotten together and started. And he's sort of the leader of the gang. At first, you know, first I wanted to call it a Hellfire Club. That might be a little misleading, but this was a club that wanted excitement, sought excitement. You know, they're living in this dull bourgeoisie life. They feel unfulfilled. You know, they all have spouses. They have children. You know, they're upper crust of society. You know, they've got money, all of that. But they're bored. And we'll tell you about the other two guys in just a minute here. But William, he starts his club. It's like a thrill seekers club. I guess that's the best way to look at it. Looking for something that will thrill them, something different. Now, the wives think that they're involved with charities because on the fourth Sunday of every month, they take off for the night. And the story, their cover story is that they are helping a charity in East London. Now, if you remember anything about the history of 19th century London, East London is the red light district. This is where Jack the Ripper operated. A lot of crime, a lot of prostitution, you know, a lot of what people call, you know, Sin Row. And that's, you know, they're going down and supposedly helping at a soup kitchen in East London. We get to very quickly, we size up William early on in this film. He's brutal to his wife and his daughter. He is very self-righteous, always quoting the Bible, calling everything that he disagrees with blasphemous. Everything's an offense to God and all that. And he's got a daughter who is of age, and we'll tell you about her in just a minute. But just to make a long story short, he doesn't want her to see her any men or anything like that. He's just totally opposed to that. We're going to find out about the hypocrisy of that in just a minute. We have seen Jeffrey Keane in a lot of films in Great Britain, but most noticeably in James Bond films. He played a member of the defense ministry in several James Bond films. So once you see him, you'll know him right off the bat. Right off the bat. Now, the second member of our Thrill Seekers Club is a man that by the character's name is Samuel Paxton, played by Peter Salas. Peter Salas was mainly seen in television. I didn't recognize him when I saw him in this for the first time, and I haven't seen him that much. But if you get a chance to see some old 60s and 70s British television, you're going to recognize him. But most of his work was almost exclusively in television. We're getting to the point now in some of these Hammer films where we're seeing more television actors come into the fray, more so than film actors. So that gives you sort of an idea that Hammer has had to reduce their budgets a little bit. There was a talk that they were thinking of bringing on Vincent Price as a member of this club, as a fourth member of this club, but they couldn't afford him. The budget wouldn't allow it. So at this point, you know, things are backing off just a little bit. Our final member of this Thrill Seekers Club is Jonathan Secker. That's the character's name, and he's played by John Carson. Now, John Carson might be a little more familiar looking to some folks. He made a lot of appearances in British film and television, but especially in a lot of films that came across to the United States, and you'll recognize him. You'll recognize him for sure. He was one that I remember the first time I saw this. I couldn't maybe place where I saw him, but I knew he was a familiar face. He did a lot of films for Hammer and a lot of British films in general. Some of the other people you're going to see that are not as familiar, Linda Hayden, who plays Alice Hargood, she's the daughter. that is, I want to say, almost abused by the father. I mean, just he emotionally abuses her. She's been acting forever, but one of the films you're going to remember her for, if you're a monster kid, is Blood on Satan's Claw, which would come out the same year, 1970. She plays Angel Blake in that. And that was a film not done by Hammer, but by Tigon, which was, you know, the Hammer wannabe. And then she plays a pregnant teenage hitchhiker in Something to Hide. That was a Peter Finch tour de force involving murder and insanity and that sort of thing. So she was no stranger to horror films. And then she did parents, the kind of films you don't want your kids to see. You know, Britain was known in the 70s for a lot of softcore comedies, and she did several of those during the 70s as well. And then comes back with Murder on the Orient Express. She had a brief role in The Boys from Brazil, and then got out of the business not too long after that. But she does a pretty good job of Alice in this, as the ingenue, and she comes under, of course, you've always got the gal that Dracula has his eyes on, and she's the one that draws his attention. We're going to tell you why as well, not just because of what she is, that she's just a woman, but because of who she is, that she is the daughter of William Hargood. That is going to be a very important thing. Gwen Watford plays Hargood's wife, Martha. Not well known in this country, but was well known in Great Britain on television appearances. Some of the other people you're going to see, a brother and sister, played by Anthony Higgins and Isla Blair. Both of them might be familiar to American audiences. They did a lot of British television, and a little bit came across and did some things that were seen in the United States. Anthony plays Peter Paxton, and he is the love interest of Alice. So, you know, he's the young man that William is he hates because he's got an interest in his daughter. And he would have done that with anybody that showed an interest in his daughter. Our other relative of our Thrill Seeker Club is played by Martin Jarvis. He's the son of Jonathan Secker. And Marvin, again, is going to be someone that's almost exclusively known to audiences in Great Britain. Now, that brings us to a very key character in this film. This is the guy that almost played our vampire, then was replaced by Christopher Lee when Christopher Lee decided that he was going to step into the fray and play the role. And that's Ralph Bates. Now, we talked about Ralph not too long ago because he also appeared in a lot of Hammer horror films. Lust for a Vampire and Dr. Jekyll and Sister Hyde, as well as the horror Frankenstein. So 1970 was a good year for Ralph Bates. Ralph Bates plays Lord Courtly. Now, we're going to meet Lord Courtly pretty early on in this, and he's the one that's going to put all the evil into motion. Because like I was saying when we first started the podcast, he was the acolyte for Count Dracula. Now, get back to our timeline now that we've got our cast of characters. These are pretty much the main people you're going to see throughout this film. There'll be a couple of other familiar faces that'll be recognizable to you. One in particular that we talk about all the time in Hammer films especially, because he's been in just about every Hammer film that we've talked about, and that is Michael Ripper, who plays the police inspector. Because there can be a lot of murders that occur in this. Dracula ends up killing like six people in this film. And Michael Ripper is going to be our police inspector. Michael Ripper is like the go-to guy on every Hammer film. And of course, we saw him in Dracula's Risen from the Grave. We saw him in Dracula, Prince of Darkness. We've seen him in virtually every Hammer Dracula film ever made. Just a very, very popular actor among those of us who are Hammer fans. And you're going to see, I won't say a cameo appearance, but it's more of her introductory appearance. If you're a fan of Madeline Smith, and I think the last time we talked about Madeline Smith may have been when Madeline Brumby and I talked about Clash of the Titans, because she had a role in that as well. But Madeline Smith, very, very pretty. She's very young in this. This is one of her first films. It's her first Hammer horror film. And she plays a prostitute in this by the name of Dolly. Now, we're going to meet Dolly in just a second. So we've got Jonathan, Samuel, and William. They've got this Thrill Seekers Club. And after coming home from church and this exchange between William and Alice, he's very upset with the way she was talking to Paul. Yes, she was flirting with him and strutting her female wares all over the place. And she wasn't. She wasn't doing anything. She was just talking to the guy. Of course, Paul is madly in love with her, and he can't understand why he can't get in the good graces of William. But William just treats him miserably like he does everybody else. So I've had this big fallout, and of course, you've got the wife stuck in the middle of all of this, trying to, you know, Martha, she's trying to make peace. Says that she's had the chef make a ham just like he wants it. And of course, what does he say? No, I'm leaving tonight. I'm not going to be here for dinner. You know that. I don't have supper on the fourth Sunday of the month. What's wrong with you? Oh, yes, you go do your charity work. I forgot. And he goes, you know, storming out of the house to the carriage. It's waiting to pick him up, and then picking up the other guys, Samuel and Jonathan. And they head down to the east side, and it's a soup kitchen. You know, throng of crowds all over the place. You know, there's a lot of poverty at this time. They make their way through the soup kitchen, and so you could tell the way they're sort of elbowing their way through the crowd. They must not be much help to these guys, and they go back to a secret area, which William reminds the guy that's taking back. He says, "I know where I'm going. I've been here before." So they've been here quite a lot. And it's a brothel. There's a brothel hiding behind this soup kitchen. It's a great cover. So that if the police ever come looking for anything, they're not going to find it. Because it's just, you know, it's all covered in by this soup kitchen. And you know, all these rich guys, you know, in their little rooms with their women. But, of course, this is the Thrill Seeker Club. These three, you know, they pay good money for this. They get a private room. And a bunch of girls, dancing girls. We see a girl dancing with a boa constrictor, and you know, they all have their women, and all of a sudden the door flings open and Lord Courtly walks in. Of course, William is totally incensed. What are you doing in here? This is our private room. And while Samuel's saying, "Hey, that's Lord Courtly. I recognize him. I know who he is. Back off. His family's, you know, very, very important." I guess, and from the way they're acting, everybody knows Lord Courtly. Throws a lot of weight around. He's a young guy. You know, he's a young guy. This is a young Ralph Bates. He grabs one of the women and says, "Come on," and hauls her off. Well, William sends off all of the women. They have a little discussion, he and Samuel and Jonathan. And as they're getting ready to leave, he goes after Lord Courtly, but not for what you think. He says, "I got a proposition for you. I want to take you to supper. The three of us do." And so they go to supper, and of course, Courtly's very, very intrigued with this. And he basically hears the story, how they say, "We want something different. We're bored. Even with what we were doing tonight. We do it all the time now. We want something unique." And Lord Courtly says, it goes on and on, and I won't give you the whole blow-by-blow, but it's pretty much, how far are you willing to go to do something different? And then pretty much, they'll go as far as they can. And he says, "Even turning your soul over to the devil?" And the three of them go, "Yeah, yeah, even that." So they meet later that night at an old church, an old desanctified church. But first, before they go there, they go by Weller's little store. Because he says, "You guys better come up with some money. Because you got to buy something in order to do this." Can you guess what it is? It's the cape and the locket. And a flask of the dried blood of Dracula. In fact, William goes, "That looks like dust." But they show him the Dracula pennant. He says, "No, this is the real thing." So at the desanctified church where they agree to meet, Courtly's there, all excited. They set up the altar for this ceremony. And of course, can you guess? Of course, it's going to be a blood ceremony. He asked, did you people bring the goblets that I asked you to bring? They brought a goblet for each of them and for Courtly. So they got four goblets. He puts a little of the blood, the dried blood, into each goblet, including his own. And then they watch him pull out this huge knife, and he cuts the palm of his hand and starts dropping the blood in each goblet. And all of a sudden, this is sort of a cool effect, because all of a sudden the blood just starts forming out of this dried blood. Next thing you know, the goblet is filled with Dracula's blood. And Courtly says, drink it. Drink it. William gets close. He puts it to his lips and he can't do it. Samuel can't do it, neither can Jonathan. Courtly just chugs it and almost immediately falls down in agony. He is in some serious pain. And of course, the other three just sort of panic and they end up beating him to death with their canes and running out now that they've murdered him. I'm going to be skipping over this story a lot, but what happens, of course, is that Courtly has set into motion Dracula's resurrection. And again, the effects aren't as good as we've seen in other Hammer films, but they're not bad. They're not as bad as some of the critics might make them out to be. They're at a very tight budget. I can't give you the specific budget figures. That's how tight it was. They never were released. But needless to say, all of a sudden, when the mist all blows away around Courtly's corpse, we see the Count. Christopher Lee is Count Dracula. And he says he will get those three. He will destroy them. And from then on out, it's your traditional Hammer Dracula revenge film. First thing he does is he gets Alice and puts her under his spell. William is going nuts because he, the whole guilt that he's feeling for this whole thing. And of course, William is the first to fall under as a victim of the Count. I'm not going to explain to each of you, each one of the deaths and how they are, because I really want you, if you haven't seen this film and you're still listening to the podcast, I want you to see this. Let's just say one by one, directly, I mean, this is where the film gets really dark. Paul's not sure what to make out of all of this. Alice disappears. William is killed and buried. So Paul hangs close to Martha, trying to help her cope with everything because she's feeling guilt. And then slowly, Paul's sister, Lucy, she becomes a victim. Alice makes herself known to Lucy, has her meet her at the church, at the desanctified church. And guess who's there? Oh, yeah. Dracula's there, and that's the end of Lucy. And later on, we've got one of those traditional scenes where Jonathan Secker has figured it out, what's going on, and he grabs Samuel and says, this is what we've got to do. They find Lucy's corpse, I should say, but it's her undead corpse, in the desanctified church, and he can't bring himself to stake her, so Jonathan says, I'll do it. You go on back home, and I will take care of this so we can free her soul. And Samuel just can't. He starts leaving, and he pulls out his gun and points it at Jonathan and says, no, you can't do it. She's my daughter and all that. And he shoots him in the shoulder. And then Lucy wakes up because Samuel has second thoughts about it, and he grabs the stake, and he's going to do it. And we can see this a mile away, just before he stakes her, she wakes up. And all of a sudden, Alice is there, Dracula's there, Lucy is there, and that's the end of Samuel. And of course, Jonathan makes his way back home, and he's very, very weak from the gunshot wound, and he's the next to go. And then his son Jeremy gets it as well. It all leads to a big confrontation in the church. Paul has figured it out too, because as Jonathan is dying, Paul gets there as Jonathan is dying. I won't tell you how. That's a great surprise. I don't want to spoil that surprise for you. And Jonathan tells him it's a vampire, and he points him towards a book. Tells him to be careful, but he has to do what he has to do. And we see Paul at the church during the daytime. He's putting up crosses all over the place. He's setting up the altar like it would be for a regular church. And later that night, he confronts Alice, and Dracula shows up. And this is the part where it's a little weak. The story's a little weak. There's a major spoiler coming up. it's not bad, and it took me a couple of viewings of this to really understand it. So when I first saw this in the movie theaters in 1971, I didn't quite like the ending. I mean, it was like, oh, okay. You know, I accepted it, but it's not really what I expected. But what ended up happening is Paula's got a cross that he uses to keep Dracula at bay, but Alice knocks it out of his hand. Dracula's up in the upper regions of the church, so he's swooping down over him. But he backs up against one of the stained glass windows, and there's a cross there, and the light of the moon shining through the cross burns him. So he smashes the stained glass, and this is where it gets a little strange, but I finally understood it after a couple of viewings. This is when I saw it later in high school, then in college, again, because this one got broadcast a few times on the late night monster movie circuit. Basically, Paul, in setting the church up with all these crosses as a trap for Dracula so he couldn't get out and run away, because all of the exits were blocked by crosses. He's up there, he sees them all, and all of a sudden he can hear the Lord's Prayer being prayed. Now, no one's praying it, but it's a suggestion that Paul's actions, by doing what he did, re-sanctified the church. So now all of a sudden Dracula realizes he is in a sanctified church, and he falls off the precipice of the second story that he's standing upon onto the altar, onto the actual altar, which is now a sanctified altar. Alice is brought back to her human state. She never was fully converted, and Dracula turns to dust. And all that's left is what we saw at the end of and at the beginning of this movie and at the end of Dracula, Prince of Darkness, just dust, cape, and his locket as we see Paul and Alice walking off. Like I said, at first, you know, the first seeing of this, the ending was not what I expected, but I accepted it. But then when I finally sort of realized what was going on, when I had a chance to really study the ending, and I realized what had happened and what they were suggesting, it was like, okay, that's different, you know? That's pretty different. And I sort of like that. So folks, I would say this is a good vampire movie. It's not a great vampire movie. And it's not one of Hammer's best, but it's certainly not their worst. And I think it's well worth a look. And I think it's an appropriate sequel to Dracula, Prince of Darkness. Now, when The Scars of Dracula came out later this year, 1970, it was not shot as a sequel to this one. Totally different film. Totally different standalone film. So this, technically, I guess you could say, ends the run from Horror of Dracula. This would be the last in that series. And then, again, we would see some of the next ones not quite up to par. With one exception, I still think Dracula AD 72 is a pretty strong feature. That was just misunderstood by a lot of the audience and definitely by the critics. So I think you need to check this one out. If you've not seen Taste the Blood of Dracula, it is well worth a look. Like I said, it's well directed. Peter Sassany does a great job with this, balancing the brilliant colors and all of that with creating a pall over this film. If right from the very beginning, you can feel it's always cloudy. It's always gray. There's just something not right going on. He does a great job of presenting that. Now, if you are listening to this show, we have just finished up with Monsterama, and hope I saw some of you while we were there. But we will be coming back with you this next, a little late. We make this one our Halloween edition because Halloween will be tomorrow. So next week, we'll finish off our werewolf series with American Werewolf in London. And Clay Sarah will return again. We'll have all the technical problems we had this week taken care of. So folks, thanks for your support. Have a very safe and happy Halloween tomorrow. And we'll see you next Monday.
I love that Star Trek does what adventure programs do. It's fun characters going on adventures wearing colorful outfits, but it tries to be more than that. It tries to say something more about humanity and tries to encourage us to be better people.
I love that it gives a really positive and really hopeful view of the future.
I like that you never know what you get with Trek, from Captain Pike to Picard to Captain Proton.
I like the Ferengi.
Earth Station Trek, a show where we talk about Star Trek from the early days on NBC to the future on Paramount Plus and everywhere in between.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping for the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.